Hello, I know most of you at least by face, and you know me at least by face. If I haven't met you personally, I'd like to sometime. If you're a visitor, I'd like to tell you my name is Mark Lanier, and I am a Lanier. And I come from Lanier's, and I like to eat. My dad was a Lanier. His dad, my pawpaw, a Lanier. They've been Lanier's for a long time. I went back and tried to figure out how far back we go because I'd been told we were related to a poet named Sidney Lanier from Georgia. Lake Lanier in Atlanta, outside Atlanta, is named after Sidney Lanier. Sidney Lanier had been a lawyer for a while. A famous poet, wrote the Song of the Chattahoochee, which I'm sure we're all waiting for it to be put to music. I don't know really directly or indirectly how related I may be to Sidney Lanier, but it's what I've been told, so I've gone back and tried to look. Well, we have problems when I do the genealogy search, because my pawpaw, my grandfather on my dad's side, was raised in Palestine, Texas, or reared, I guess, in Palestine, Texas, by his uncle, because his father had passed away. So I have trouble using the census records and things like that trying to find my great-grandfather. I could put it this way. If Pawpaw, as we called him, is Grandpa 3, because he's my grandfather third generation back, me being generation 1, Dad generation 2, Pawpaw would be generation 3. I have trouble finding Grandpa 4, if you know what I mean. There are lots of ways you can look, by the way. The internet's made it a whole lot easier, too. But you can get U.S. Census records. You can get, if you go to certain counties, you can get burial records. You can get birth certificates if you know the right place to go. You can check newspaper accounts. Lots of things. But can you imagine if I wanted to try and find Grandpa 165? How much trouble I'm going to have. Grandpa 3, Pawpaw, was born in the early 1900s, I think like 1907 or so. Maybe it was 1914, I'm not sure, but early 1900s. But if you just figure everybody has a kid at age 25, because it's easier mathematically, Grandpa 165, he goes back to 2000 B.C., Now, I've not been able to find exactly who he was. I suspect he was a lawyer. One of the originators of racquetball. But I've never been able to confirm any of that. Some might say, are you sure you had a Grandpa 165? To which I can affirmatively say, of course, had to have. I just can't tell you any details about him. We've lost track. The family tree has been chopped down a few times and put through the shredder since then. Okay? So I don't know how far back you can take your genealogy. I've looked for a birth certificate for Grandpa 165, figuring he was from Mesopotamia. But I haven't been able to find one. So I looked for an obituary. Okay, they had really bad newspaper print back in 2000 BC. The justification, the margins, it was all messed up. But I haven't been able to find an obituary for Grandpa 165. I went the next step. I looked for a tombstone, but I haven't been able to find that either. Did I have Grandpa 165? Most assuredly, yes. Can I tell you anything about him? Absolutely not. Now, I bring this up as an introduction to this lesson because we're going to study Abraham today. And Abraham lived about the same time as my Grandpa 165. Namely, around 2000 BC. Some scholars put him earlier, some scholars put him later. But here he is, smack dab in the middle of the Middle Bronze Age in Mesopotamia. And it's interesting to me because some scholars, if you read scholastic Judaic history, there is a big debate, and scholars divide camps over where Israel got its beginning. Because there are a number of noteworthy, very wise, smart scholars who say Abraham was an invention to give credit to the Jewish nation and would have been invented sometime around 800 BC. Not an actual historical figure. And what amazes me is one of the principal reasons these scholars believe that is because there's no evidence of Abraham outside of the Bible. Well, give me a break. I'm not saying there aren't some other reasons that need seriously addressing, but that's not one I give much credibility to. Because science teaches us that there were about 20 plus million people on planet Earth at the time. They did not have the internet. They didn't have newspapers. They were writing on clay tablets. Can you imagine as the paper boy throwing those? You're not going to find evidence of one guy who lived that far ago, unless maybe he's the king of Sumeria or something like that. And then you'll find him on a king list or something. But Abram at the time, he wasn't anything special beyond what God saw in him and what God did with him. In the eyes of the Lord, he was of supreme importance and specialness. And history records him as a very special, as a unique man. But to his day and age, he's not. He's one of the boys of Terah, his dad. Married to Sarai, who can't even have children. So the fact that we don't have any extra biblical evidence doesn't mean anything to me. If we had extra biblical evidence of Abraham, I'd view it very suspiciously because it'd just be so odd to have such a thing. So if we don't have from archaeology some evidence of Abraham, why is archaeology even important? What does archaeology bring to the table? What use is archaeology when we study Abraham? Well, of great use, actually. Because archaeology, what it does is it puts the history we have, the biblical account and the biblical history we have, into context. So we're able to read about Abraham in the Bible and through archaeology understand the context of what his life was about and what was going on. Some of it in ways that helps us, and some of it ways that's useful. Some of it in ways that, I don't know if it's that helpful, it's just kind of interesting. I've thrown a little bit of that, both measures, into today's lesson. Not because I want to give you stuff that's useless, but interesting. But because I want us to understand more than anything else, if you get one thing out of class today other than some head knowledge, it's an understanding that Abraham was a real person like you and me. Abraham was a real person like you, like me, and like the person sitting next to you. And God had a one-to-one with Abram. And while at the time he may not have seemed special in the eyes of the world, he was special in the eyes of God because God was at work in his life. And so we have a tendency to think of certain figures in a world by themselves. One of our daughters, Sarah, just graduated from elementary school, fifth grade. And her teacher this year was Mr. Shives. Great teacher. If you ever have to do fifth grade again, do it under him. I am. That's where I'm going. He had taught Rebecca, another one of our daughters, and he taught Sarah. And Sarah and her friends were talking yesterday. In fact, she was talking to our cousin Davis, who also had Mr. Shives. Her cousin Davis, our nephew. And she said, you know, I saw Mr. Shives at the shoe store. and you could tell it totally freaked her out. Like, teachers shouldn't buy shoes. They are surely born on their feet, you know. Heaven forbid. And she said, can you imagine that? He was buying shoes. Because we have this tendency to think of people who are set apart in some capacity. We have a tendency to think of them as unhuman almost, superhuman. Abraham was human. He bought shoes or made them. He went to the bathroom. He got stomach viruses. He got bored. He sweat. Some days he woke up and his back was stiff. There were days he did not want to work, but he had to. He was told to do things that he got excited about. He was told to do things he didn't want to do. That's Abraham. So let's put him into some historical context to better understand the way God was working. Now we meet Abraham. We're throwing up a map. We're throwing up scripture next to the side of it. But this is a map of Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia comes from two Greek words. Meso, meso means in the middle. Potamos is the Greek for river. So this is in the middle of the rivers. You've got the Mesopotamia, the land in between the Euphrates on the southern end and the Tigris on the north. That's Mesopotamia. That's the land between the two rivers. So that's the land where we start our adventure with Abraham. And we read about him in Genesis chapter 11, starting, I've started with verse 27 here, and that's where the story really starts. Now these are the generations, Toledot in the Hebrew. This is where, what follows is the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. If we were reading it in Hebrew, it'd read Haran with a ch sound, okay? Fathered those three. Now they're put in that order because that's probably the order they came in. Abram's the oldest. Nahor and Haran. Haran has his own kid, names him Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah, the Hebrew, Panay, in the face of, right in front of his dad. The youngest son dies before the face of, in front of his dad, Terah, in the land of his kindred. Now that in Hebrew, it's his birthplace, in the land of his, singular his, Haran's birthplace, Ur of the Chaldees, the Chaldeans. Ur is this little town down there. Let's see, get rid of the rivers. There it is, Ur. It was a port city at the time because silt has driven the Red Sea further south. It was an old city. If we're looking at 2000 BC, there's evidence of this city being around for thousands of years before that as a ruling city. It wasn't huge by today's standards, about 170 acres, but by those standards, very big city and a ruling city for a millennium. So what happens is this is Ur. Now, it's not Ur of the Chaldees until later. That's a later biblical editor adding that to distinguish it from other Urs. The Chaldeans don't come around for another 1,000 years. But Ur of the Chaldeans, that's the Ur where they were. That's the Ur where Terah was born, and that's the Ur where Terah died. Now, if we're looking at something 2000 or 1900 BC, we've got some insight from a number of digs that have happened over there. We know that coming down from the north and the west were Western Semites. They called them Amorites. And they were migrating down to Ur. Now the Western Semites, they spoke a Semitic language. It was a different language than what the natives to Ur would be speaking, an Akkadian Sumerian type. But they came down with a Western Semitic tongue, and they came in and they were immigrating, if you will. It was a huge immigration. And it's interesting to see how scholars piece this together. They not only have information about it directly from some tablets they've unearthed, but they can also find names that are referenced, and there are catalogs of all the names. And you see these West Semitic names coming down into Mari and down further south into Ur and in these areas. So there's some migration of Semites down. And scholars tend to believe that Abram and his family were part of that migration down to Ur. Because Abram, Nahor, Terah, even Haran, those are Semitic names. They're not names that would be native to Ur. So you can imagine that this migration comes down. Dad, Terah, takes the boys and the families and the properties and the crops. They go down to the big capital city. But things were not all that they had been historically in Ur. In 2004, Ur gets overthrown. Ur's going through a lot of turmoil, a lot of problems, a lot of it because of the immigration issue. It's caused food shortages. It's caused inflation. Immigration is not just a modern problem. It was an issue back then, and the lawmakers didn't know what to do. History repeats itself. So, what happens? Well, you can see the dad who's left his homeland, he's left his people, he's left his heritage, he's gone down to where he thinks there's going to be something great, he's gone down to Ur, and his baby son dies in front of his face. You're not going to be surprised to find he turns around and heads back home. That's not the place he wanted to stay. Now, Ur itself, though, an amazing place. We tend to think of these as primitive people because it's 2000 BC, it's Middle Bronze Age. We tend to think of Ur as, or even this period of time, as something so old that and so primitive that it's almost caveman-like. And it wasn't at all. Starting with a gentleman named Woolley. Back in the 1800s, excavations were done at Ur, and they've unearthed a lot of things. Ur would not look very different today than it did there if we get it over to where the river is. That river has moved from silt over the years and continues to move. But this is a picture that is very typical of what the land would have looked like at the time of Abraham. So you've got the land. This is the place where the big ziggurat that we showed when we talked about the Tower of Babel. This is the Ur is the place where that ziggurat had been built. And it was built by the time of Abram. It was built to the moon god, Nana, also the god of bull. Could have been a lawyer. Different kind, sorry. The moon god. And the moon god... Nana was now understand they had thousands of gods, but each town had like their patron god that was a special god looking over that town. That was Nana for Ur. And so Ur is Nana was worshipped with the ziggurat, or there would have been a temple adjoining the ziggurat, and there's a royal tomb there where they've excavated. And they found, they call this the ram caught in the thicket. Because when it was first found, scholars thought, oh, someone built what Abraham experienced when he tried to sacrifice Isaac, and there was a ram caught in the thicket. You see the ram kind of caught or hiding behind the trees playing hide and seek? Scholars later figured out that's not at all what that is. As far as a ram caught in the thicket and a tribute to Abraham. But it predates probably Abraham and his experience to some degree. But it's a ram as a decorative item. That they had things like that. They had, this is jewelry. There was a lovely queen. That was her headdress. Kind of cool. They put it on a model in the museum. But it gives you an idea of these are real people. These are, you know, they deal with these things. This is a musical instrument, a lyre, that was also found in the burial areas. And so all of these things tell you, this is their Monopoly game. I don't know what they called it, and I'm not sure what the rules are. But I'm confident Lewis would claim he's winning, whether he is or not. There's still more. So this is Ur. And this is where the family goes, and this is where the family leaves from. So the family goes down to Ur, and then they went forth together from Ur. They were going to go back. They were going to go to Canaan. Maybe back, maybe not. But they were going to Canaan, and on the way back, they came to Haran, and they settled there. Haran is where the arrows end, just to the top right of where the inn is in Western. You can see Haran. Now, you may be thinking, oh, gee, did they name it after the boy? No, you get that in English, but in Hebrew, it's a different spelling. Different letters are used. One is Haran, one is Haran. One has a chet, one has a hey. Different letters of the alphabet. So they go up to this town. It's also a trading town. It's on a caravan route. It's on a tributary of the Euphrates River. So they go up and they settle in Haran, and it's in Haran where they stopped instead of going all the way to Canaan. But Abram, now we hit chapter 12. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land. It's important we get this into our brain the way it happened. Dad decides to move the family after the youngest boy's death home. They're going to go to Canaan, but they stopped in Haran. Maybe that was home. Dad says, we're just going to stay here. We're not going all the way to Canaan. And he stops. Then the word of the Lord, not the moon god, but Jehovah God. The word of the Lord comes to Abram, and if you read it in the Hebrew, it's very emphatic. It doesn't say just go. It says, go yourself. You go. Everybody else may not be going, but you go. You take anybody with you that's going, and you go. That means you're going to leave your dad. That means you're going to leave your family, your home, your genealogy, your family tree. That means you're going to leave all that there is. Abram, firstborn son, would have been entitled to possessions. You're leaving all of that. You're taking what you already have and you're going. You're going not only from your country, you're going from your kindred, you're going from your father's house to a land that I'm going to show you when you get there. And Abram responds, and he goes. Now, it's interesting when he goes, because God gives him more of everything than what he left. He left a country. God makes of him a country, Israel. He left his kindred. God makes him the father of a multitude, more numerous than the dust of the earth. He left his father's house. God makes him, Avram, father in Hebrew, a house through whom all nations of the world will be blessed. God calls him and God blesses him. And if you're reading it in the Hebrew, it's really stark to see the contrast between what God's had to do for the last 8 chapters of Genesis versus what God does here. Before, Genesis is a book, if you ever take Hebrew, at least when I took it, it was the first reading that we did outside of learning the grammar. And it's really easy to read. It's very good narrative. But it's also very easy because it's repetitive of certain words and phrases. And so you pick up on it. You read this in the Hebrew and you're going to see some repetition. Look at the contrast. I want to pull out 5 curses God's given before Abram. He cursed the snake above all the livestock. He cursed the ground. He cursed Cain. Out of the ground, the Lord has cursed everybody and everything. Cursed be Canaan, we read after Noah. Curse, 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 curse. 5 curses. And yet in the first 3 verses of chapter 12, as this page is turned and you reach Abram, and Abram is told to go, 5 times some form of the word bless is used. 1 for every curse that's been written about. I will bless you as a great nation. I will make, I will bless. It's the same word. I will bless you as a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you. In you all the nations shall be blessed. All of that within three words. It's a very stark difference between what God's been doing through sinful, what sin has called forth from the mouth of God in curse. Faithful obedience is called forth from the mouth of God in blessing. And so that's what we have. So now, Abram then, he goes down to Ur, he turns around, he heads back to Haran, and from there he goes down into Canaan. And in Canaan, he pauses several places and he builds an altar to Jehovah God. By the way, this little side freebie. Do you know who the territorial god of Haran was? Out of the thousands of gods they had? Also Nana, the moon god, which some scholars think may be the religion of Abram's youth, because dad seems to be moving from one city protected by Nana to another city protected by Nana and back again. Abram has none of that. Abraham builds his temple to Jehovah God. And he worships and calls on Jehovah God for his blessing and his direction in his life. Now, at this point in time, God blesses him and he says, you look all around you. This is going to be your land. This is going to be the land of your descendants. It's going to be all yours. It's without measure. It's without scope. Your descendants the same way. That's yours. And you know what happens? Famine sets in. So our traveler now, he travels to Ur. He goes back to Haran. By the way, that's about five. Look at the mileage thing there. See it right above where it says desert, 250 miles. So this is about a 600-mile journey down, 600-mile journey back. Then he does about a 500-mile journey down to Canaan. And then he's got problems as he calls on the name of the Lord because there's a famine. So he decides to leave. Famine sets in. Do you think he goes home? No. If my audio were working, you'd be hearing the Bengals singing Walk Like an Egyptian right now. Because what Abram does is he goes down to Egypt and decides he'll live out the famine there with everybody. Now, down in Egypt, we've got some problems. Abram's scared because his wife is really good looking and he's worried about what's going to happen. So Abram tells Sarah that she's supposed to tell the Egyptians that she's Abram's sister as opposed to his wife, lest they kill him and take his wife. Sister, they're not going to kill him for the sister. They figure they can have her automatically. So Abram doesn't tell her to tell the truth. He tells her to lie. Oh, some scholars say, well, maybe he had adopted her as well as married her. Maybe his dad had adopted her when he married her. So technically she was his sister. Come on, it's a lie. Okay? Let's don't reach. Abram lied. And he told his wife to lie. And no good thing comes from the lie. Oh, it looked good at first because Pharaoh gets interested in her. And so Pharaoh says, hey, I'm going to give you a bunch of stuff. And I'm going to take Sarah. And Abram and Pharaoh takes Sarah into his household. Well, Jehovah God's got plans for Sarah. They don't include Pharaoh. Maybe Pharaoh's descendants later, but that's another part of the story. So what God does is he brings a curse on Pharaoh and his household. And Pharaoh figures out what's going on, goes to Abram, says, why have you done this? And kicks Abram out. Now, why would Abram do that? Like I say, some scholars say one thing, some say another. It's fascinating. This is not something new that we're wondering about. It's bothered people for thousands of years. When the Dead Sea Scroll discovery was done, they found something called Genesis Apocryphon. And Genesis Apocryphon is made up stories to try and help explain Genesis. And it says that Pharaoh fell in love with her long and delicate fingers and her really pretty fingernails. Now, it also gives some other features about her that we'll leave out of this class. But leave it to say that Pharaoh thought she was really good looking. That was one theory. Other theories are that women were actually swapped to confirm a deal. You know, it's kind of it's the ancient handshake. Instead of shaking hands, it's okay, I'll give you one of my women, you give me one of yours. I got four daughters. I could be deal king. But we don't do that, do we, Rebecca? No. We don't know what happened. But this type of trade and this type of I won't say immigration, but this movement of Canaanites into Egypt and Egyptians into Canaan was common in that time period. In fact, archaeologists have found a story of Sinuhe. Sinuhe was supposedly, and some archaeologists believe that this was a fictionalized story, others believe a real story, but he was within Pharaoh's court. Sinuhe is implicated in a murder, so Sinuhe heads off to Canaan to get away from everything. And when he heads off to Canaan, he lives like a Canaanite. And so we have an ability to read and see what the life of a Canaanite like Abraham would have been. This is in the time period of Abraham. And he lives in a tent in a nomadic fashion. And he eats really good. He eats figs. He eats grapes. He eats honey. He has fruit platters. Barley, wild game, birds, fowl, fish. He has filet mignon. It's in Egyptian, it's written beef. But you and I both know if you're going to eat beef, what part you're going for first. Filet mignon. He has olive oil. He has wine. And yes, milk. This is what life would have been like for a Canaanite nomad like Abram and his family. So they wander through. Now, let me tell you what Abram looked like. I want him to be a real guy to you. He ate real food. He told lies. He moved around a lot. What else do we know? Well, there is a wonderful mural on one of the tombs in Egypt that showed the interaction of Egyptians when some Canaanites came to Egypt. So these are the pictures of the Canaanites, not the guys in the lower right. Those two are Egyptians. The Canaanites are in the top picture and in the lower left. Here's what we have from the Canaanites. First of all, whoops, they're wearing sandals, the men are. See the sandals? You couldn't see them long. Let's see if we can do better on the next picture. The women are wearing these moccasin-like shoes. See those? I don't know if those are socks. Probably tube socks. Moccasin-type shoes is what the women were wearing. They had this real 1980s mullet-type thing going on with their hair. See? I got one of them 1980s pictures. Andre Agassi. Yeah, that was a 1980s mullet look. And they shaved. They didn't have a mustache, even though they'd have a beard. This is what they looked like. So they'd pluck their mustache out. Yeah, that would hurt. What else can we see? The women wore these white headbands. I tried to blow it up to see if there's a Nike swoosh on them. I could not find one. But the women wore those headbands. And all in all, it was quite the place to be. So that's what they would have looked like. You've got these real people. Abram gets kicked out of Egypt and he's sent back to Canaan, and he and Lot start having problems. Their herdsmen are arguing with each other. So here's how typical this man is. This is a guy who's got family problems. This is a guy who's got who married up. His wife's better looking than he deserved. This is a guy who doesn't treat his wife the way he always should. This is a fella who is traveling, eating food, living like you and me. And God's talking to him and God's working in his life. So he goes back to Canaan. And with the strife between him and Lot, a decision's got to be made. And Abram takes the role of decider. And he says, look, here we are. We got the whole land in front. You decide where to go. I don't want strife. If you want to go left, I'll go right. You want to go right? I'll go left. You take the pick. Lot chooses the best course for himself by vision. He wants the rich land. That's just wrong. Okay, I mean, just between us. And it comes back and it bites him. He goes and he chooses the really good looking land, leaving Abram out there in the rougher territory. And as a result, when the kings come down in battle, well, they want to go conquer the good land. They don't want to go conquer the rough territory. So they go down and they take the areas where Lot is. And as we talked last week, Lot is taken away and he's captive. And when Abram hears that Lot's been taken away captive by the invading kings, he immediately swings into action and goes to get him. And the way it's written in the Hebrew, it's such a stark contrast from the way Abram acted when Sarah got taken captive by Pharaoh just a few verses earlier. Pharaoh takes captive Sarah, his wife, and Abram's reaction is fear and trembling. Lot gets taken, and Abram swings into action and says, come on, let's take 318 of our trained men. And he goes and he rescues them. I'm enamored by the story because I take it very personally. And I want you to take it personally as well. You may not be able to trace back to Grandpa 165 either. But for generation after generation after generation after generation, God's been at work in people's lives. And he works day in, day out. And he works when you move, and he works when you don't move. And he works when things go well, and he works when things aren't. And he works when you're rich, and he works when you're broke. And he works when people are treating you right, and he works when people are treating you wrong. That's the way life is. And we have Abram's story isolated because God preserved it in the thread of his tapestry of the salvation story. Abram's very important. And Paul will draw upon the faithfulness of Abram. But Paul never draws upon Abram's righteous behavior. Because Abram's righteous behavior was no better than yours or mine. What God has in the tapestry, this thread of Abram that Paul's able to draw out and to use to illustrate so beautifully, is a story of Abram being faithful to God in the midst of Abram being a sinner. And it's his faith that's reckoned to him as righteousness. It's not his behavior. It's the trust that Abram had in the Lord, in spite of the fact that even that trust was inadequate. Even that trust didn't extend to honesty in front of Pharaoh. But the trust was there, and God took that trust and he honored it. So where does this give us to go home? First point for home, cursings and blessings. Paul says in Galatians, do not be deceived, God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that also shall he reap. If I am going to sow tomato seeds in my garden, I should never expect to be picking broccoli once they reach fruit. What you sow, you reap. Abram sowed some positive things, and he reaped positive things. Abram sowed negative things and he reaped negative things. I assure you, there were marital problems once Sarah left Pharaoh's household. And I assure you that Abram probably swallowed them all because it was him who sowed the seed to start with. You know, it's just something that we need to understand. Sin has a curse. Paul talks about in Romans 8, the curse of sin and death. J.B. Phillips translates it as a vicious cycle of sin and death. You know, sin, if you stick your hand in a fire, it's going to burn. Hey, look, we got young kids in here. I got young kids and nephews and niece in here. I want to tell you something. You choose sin and it burns. The reason God tells us not to do certain things is not because he's a killjoy.
Hey, can't let them do that. That'll be too much fun.
It's because it's bad for us. It's not good. It won't create the character we need to have. It won't develop the personality we need. It won't develop the traits we need. It is not life. It's death. Sin brings curse and death. Faithfulness, righteousness brings life. That's true in this earth. I'm not talking eternally. God saves us apart from works. I'm talking about the here and now. If that's true, and I believe it with all my heart, why on earth would we ever choose sin? Why, all things being equal, would we say, okay, I know this is wrong. I know this is going to lead to bad things. I know this is going to be counterproductive. I know in the end I'll wish I didn't do it. But gee, I think I'll do it anyway. Typically what we do is we keep that conversation so far in the back of our brain we don't recognize it's even existing. And we just move and don't think about it, lest we have this turmoil. And so I would urge all of us to find a daily time where we are quiet before the Lord and we check our spirit and his spirit. And we just think through our day and think through what we're about. And let's make the righteous choices. And let's hold God to them and see what he does. Because God is the one who said, you, right now, go from your country to the land I'll show you. You move in faith. And when Abram did it, God honored it. God honors it. And I love this passage for several reasons. When I was 21, I got asked to speak on a Sunday morning at an old folks' home. Now, what does a 21-year-old fella have to tell a bunch of people in a retirement home? I mean, I was sitting there thinking, why did I say yes? You know, I could have gone, I could be somewhere else. Instead, I got to figure out something to say to these people who are old enough to be Grandpa Six. And this is what I spoke on. Because God does not call any of us simply to be Christians. He calls us with a mission. He calls us with a purpose. He calls us with a job. Good works he's prepared beforehand for us to walk in them, Paul says in Ephesians 2:10. And he's created us in Christ Jesus for that very purpose, for these good works that he's prepared beforehand for us to walk in them, that he's empowered us to do. If you are a Christian today, and if you are alive today, whether you're in an old folks' home or sitting in this class, if you are alive today in Christ, God has something for you to do, specific for you, tailored for you. He's got it for you. He does. So let's do it. And don't be satisfied with just getting by day to day. Finally, let there be no strife between you and me. Blessed are the peacemakers. They'll be called sons of God. That's a sermon in itself. Abram saying, you go, it's your pick. Well, I don't want to fight. Your pick, your decision, I'll take the other. I can guarantee you that Abram and Lot were not brothers. If they'd been brothers, I doubt that ever would have happened. Which one do you want? Well, that's the same one I want. But there was no sibling rivalry. That's an indirect message to my daughters. There is something to be said about being a peacemaker. So, do you want more? If you do, I'd love you to just take a moment. Don't email me these. Just write down your struggles and your choices. Just make a decision. Okay, I've got some decisions in front of me. I'm going to write it down. What's right and what's wrong? And when I see it in paper, I'm going to choose right. If you do want to email us something, I'd love to hear you email me about what it is you think God's calling you to do in your life. And what are the decisions that you need to make? If you email me, I give you my word, I will pray for you every day this week in those decisions. I'll write them down, I'll write you down, and I'll pray for you every day. Because it's very important we live up to the call of God.